Calling all conscious achievers who are seeking more community and connection, I've got an invitation for you. Join me at this year's Summit of Greatness, this September 7th through 9th in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio, to unleash your true greatness. This is the one time a year that I gather the greatness community together in person for a powerful, transformative weekend. People come from all over the world, and you can expect to hear from inspiring speakers like Inky Johnson, Jaspreet Singh, Vanessa Van Edwards, Jen Sincero, and many more. You'll also be able to dance your heart out to live music, get your body moving with group workouts, and connect with others at our evening socials. So if you're ready to learn, heal, and grow alongside other incredible individuals in the greatness community, then you can learn more at lewishouse.com/summit2023. Make sure to grab your ticket, invite your friends, and I'll see you there.
At Pixar, well, we also say that failure is part of the process. It does happen. We don't actually use the terminology very much. Now, there are times when you have something which actually does fail. So we don't avoid it. You have to, like, if something really fails, you say it. But the terminology of making a film is, since we know they all have problems, is we're trying to solve the problem. That solution didn't work. Let's try this.
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
I don't know about you, but when around 3 p.m. hits, I find myself craving the right refreshment to get me through that mid-afternoon slump. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea is full-flavored sweet tea, but without the sugar and the calories. It might take several bottles for you to believe that a delicious sweet tea can really have zero sugar and zero calories. But you know what they say, life is full of surprises. Or in this case, full of flavor. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea. Try it to believe it. For 20% off your next 12-pack, head to Amazon and use promo code 20PureLeaf. That's promo code 20PureLeaf for 20% off. We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card, you call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone if you only had a Discover card. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card. Okay, quick math. The less your business depends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/greatness. netsuite.com/greatness. Again, head to netsuite.com/greatness. Welcome back, everyone, to the School of Greatness. Very excited about our guest today. We have the inspiring Ed Catmull in the house, the co-founder of Pixar Animation and the New York Times bestselling author of Creativity, Inc., Overcoming the Unseen Forces That Stand in the Way of True Inspiration. I'm so glad that you're here. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I'm really happy to be here.
We were just chatting for the last 30 minutes before this conversation, and I'm fascinated by your story, by your life, and the things that you've seen, witnessed, overcome, and building a business, but also just building a beautiful life of your own. You were surrounded by some of the most brilliant
creatives, leaders of industry since you were in college, and you essentially grew up with these individuals in chasing after, envisioning, manifesting, creating a dream of yours to make animated films, which took you a long time. And then you've now done over 32 films since your time of starting at Pixar, I believe, and Disney, 31, 32 films. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And it's incredible to know the influence you've had on the lives of, I'm assuming, billions of people who have consumed your stories. So I just want to acknowledge you for the incredible amount of work that you've created, the incredible amount of things that you've had to overcome in building the first animation film to, you know, building a massive company, and all of the unseen forces of thousands of creative individuals coming together. The incredible magic that happens with that, but also the challenges you've had to overcome as well. So I'm so excited you're here. And we're talking about one of my favorite moments from Pixar, which was Toy Story 3 at the end, where that made me so emotionally captivated, so moved to tears at the end of this movie, that I remember watching it the first time thinking, how am I crying watching a cartoon? Like, how is this making me feel so deeply about my own life and imagining my own life? And it's just amazing what you and the entire team has been able to create. So I'm excited you're here. I'm excited for the book that has the expanded edition to it, which talks about what you learned in the last 10 years of leading Pixar and Disney Animation as well. And yeah, welcome again to the show. Very excited.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Although I also want to be careful that I don't take credit for what those other people did.
Of course.
So,
but being the leader, you know, being co-founder, leading the charge, and casting a vision and overseeing the vision is a big responsibility.
Well, that was the fun part.
Yeah.
Was, okay, how do you have these rather amazing people work well together over a long period of time, and this never changes? Like, it's today's problem is not like yesterday's problem, and it, you know, keeps changing.
Right. Right. What was the biggest challenge you had in starting that first movie? Because I remember you saying it took about 14 years of time of like saying, when will we be able to actually create this animation? I think it was 14 years from your prediction. What was the biggest challenge in waiting that long and actually putting out the first movie with Toy Story?
Well, when I first started, it was like, this was the goal was to make a film. And I naively thought that it would probably take 10 years. And I very quickly, within 2 or 3 years, was disabused of that. Like, that was just wrong. But I didn't replace it with another estimate. It's like, I really didn't know. So it was more of, okay, how do I think about the people, how we work together? But also, what are the economics of it? And what are the technical problems that need to be solved? Because initially, I thought of myself as a researcher.
Mm.
And I was thinking in terms of what are the problems that we need to solve to get there. And then while doing that, this was when I was in New York Tech, it was after I left Utah, I also found that because I was now over this group, and I was kind of avoiding actually being the manager of the group. So I was trying to have it both ways.
Yeah.
I wanted to be the person that was solving the technical problems, and I kind of like being the leader, to be honest. So I have these theories about how to manage, but I also found that I liked figuring out these kinds of problems too. That is, the relationships between people and what made them work was really interesting. So I didn't have to give up one over the other. More like a time allocation. But I would say there was a phasing over time. But I stayed pretty deeply involved in technical issues probably for the next 10 or 15 years.
On the technical side.
On the technical side.
Right. Before launching the first film.
Before launching, well, Yeah, before launching the first film.
Yes.
And because we have this rather amazing group there, and I worked on having a culture, like it was open, and we published everything we did. Now, at this point, because we're new in the industry, there were some people who thought we're pretty close. And I just felt like, well, we're not close at all. So some people were secretive about their breakthroughs. And I just thought, well, breakthroughs, schmakthroughs, we're years away.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do was to publish everything we did and completely participate in this community. And I'll have to say that a lot of my deepest friends come out of academia because we go to the same conferences. We've known each other for 50 years. But by publishing everything, we also became the place to come to. So we were bringing in the best people. And then finally Star Wars happened. And when Star Wars happened, then George Lucas was the first person in the film industry with credibility who thought that technology was going to affect the industry. Like the number one. And believe me, we had tried. And to anybody else, we were utterly and completely irrelevant. It wasn't like they didn't think we could do it. It was they didn't even think about it at all.
Wow.
So George thought it was going to be possible, so he hired me in because we had this rather amazing group.
This is late 70s now?
This would have been, yes, late 70s. Because I joined Lucasfilm in 1979.
Okay.
And when I left New York Tech and I'm trying to create this environment, I realized at that point that half of what I thought was actually worked really well. It became the foundation of what we built on. And half of what I thought was a complete crock. It didn't work at all.
Right.
But the most important thing for me was that when I went to Lucasfilm, I came away with the insight that about half of what I did was right and half was wrong. I was going to hang on to the things that were right, but I was going to try something new. But I believed that my ratio of right to wrong would probably remain 50-50 and would probably continue to be true for the rest of my life, which I have found to be true. And it isn't as if I can have a way of keeping track. I mean, you don't really know how to put numbers to this, but I felt like the value to me was understanding that I was right, or excuse me, I was wrong more than I thought I was.
You were wrong more than you thought, yeah.
Yeah. So at Lucasfilm now, it's a new educational opportunity. And George wanted to bring technology into film editing, to digital audio and into computer graphics. And now it's another educational opportunity because now you've got three customer groups, one of whom hated what we were doing. They didn't like the idea. So these are the video editors. Now, George knew video editing. He's the one that wanted it. But the person they put in charge of doing it thought it was a terrible idea.
Wow.
So, okay. So that did not end well, even though we did something which was way advanced over anything else in the industry. We didn't have a customer who wanted to use it. The digital audio had a guy who loved the idea and basically worked with us really well. But the third group was ILM. And ILM was neutral.
Mm.
Their view was, well, your resolution is too low, but if you ever get to be good enough to be used in the films, we'll use it.
Uh-huh.
So now we're the driving force. Our goal is to meet their needs, to be good enough for what they were doing because they were the best in the industry. And if we could make them happy, then we would have succeeded. So we became the driving force, nobody else. So, that was our motivation.
Right.
And those were the kinds of lessons. And the other lesson was that as a representative of Lucasfilm, I got to visit all these different companies, supercomputer companies, Cray, CDC, companies that most people don't either haven't heard of or don't remember, and also the emerging workstation companies. And they wanted to sell to Lucasfilm, so I can go in and talk with the leaders of the companies, because they wanted to sell to Lucasfilm, because Star Wars was sexy.
Yes.
And for lunch or for dinner, I'd meet with the engineers, because they knew that I was actually a real technical person. What I found was, at every one of these visits, I got two different views of a company in the same day. And I became aware that in a lot of companies, there was like a class structure, not a term they would use. People would never say, well, we're first class here. There are people who say we're treated as second class, okay? But you can see this going on in companies. And I remember thinking, this can't be good. So as we continue to grow, and at some point we began to bring in artists, especially when we became Pixar, then the one thing that was clear to me is we needed to make sure that we didn't have a notion of first class and second class, that we really had to make sure right from the beginning that we gave the message of valuing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't the same thing as saying that everybody is the same.
Yeah.
They're not. They have different skills, different capabilities, and so forth. But the notion that some people are better than others or different class, not a good thing. So the basic principle was that you actually make the assumption that everybody can be better. Not the same, but everybody can be better. And that is not a high-risk proposition.
Mm-hmm.
It is worth doing. So we were learning as we were going through this. And then we got to the point where George, you know, because he got divorced and his cash position was now completely different than he needed to sell us. So this is a year-long stressful period for us. It's a very stressful period. But part of that was by this time we had reached a level of quality because we had built some hardware in order to do high-quality images that ILM was starting to use what we had. And so part of the deal as we spun out was they had the rights to use the software that we had. And they used it in the film. I think the first major one was The Abyss. Although we had done something earlier for them, like for Star Trek, there was that thing where you flew over the planet and it turned lifelike.
Sure.
So we'd done a couple of things for them, but I found somebody to help run the graphics group. We were never part of ILM, but they needed somebody in ILM as they started that transition to digital technology.
Wow.
So we were acquired by Steve Jobs.
Wow. What year was this now?
This would be 1986.
1986, Steve Jobs acquires you. And you'd known Steve before then.
Well, I met him once, and then he just disappeared at the time we were now starting to get sold. Now, I didn't know why he disappeared. Later, of course, I learned the reason was he was in this internal struggle, which resulted in him being removed at Apple. So this was basically a public humiliation for Steve. And it largely had to do with the way he related with people. So that's kind of the mythology around Steve. And I knew Steve when he was like this. That is, his behavior around people was not empathetic. And that kind of behavior is frankly kind of, it's interesting and people like to tell stories about it and write about it. It's sort of like the bad boy behavior. And it's unfortunate because it doesn't capture the arc of Steve's life, which is far more interesting and impactful. Instead, the focus on the outside, whether it was movies or writing about him or articles, was about a period in his life. And that was a period in which he was kicked out of Apple. He started Next Computer. And Next, he did some brilliant things, like his software choices, it turns out, were fundamentally, ultimately changed, not only Next, but later Apple. His hardware choices were questionable, and he made some poor business choices.
Sure.
And choices in which he thought these were really big wins, but I was looking at them and thinking, oh, this cannot be a good idea.
Right. But he bought you guys. He bought Pixar.
So then he bought Pixar after he got them. So we knew Steve when he was like that, but we didn't have any choice. Like, we'd been spending a year. This was an utter disaster. I mean, it's a long story itself,
sure,
like the things he went through. But the end result was that Steve acquired us.
When he acquired you guys, were you excited or were you more nervous based on his personality from the past?
Well, we were excited to keep alive and keep going. So that was the excitement part.
The dream.
Yes. And Steve is like, he is, for us, and varied. I had a great relationship with Steve. So I think I worked for Steve longer than anybody else.
Wow.
And I never had an argument with Steve.
Never?
Never.
Wow.
We disagreed at times, but we never had an argument.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So listen, we all know life is full of yada yada, like those quote unquote free trials that somehow still charge your card for something, or when companies have those sneaky gotchas hiding deep in the fine print. And I know you've dealt with yada yada before, like those bills that keep going up and up for no reason at all, or when budget airlines promise a cheap fare but then charge you for every little thing until you realize you're paying more than you would have somewhere else. And yes, it is possible to outsmart yada yada, like triple checking airline deals to make sure all you need is already included, but you don't take yada yada in life, so don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Metro by T-Mobile has no contracts, no credit checks, no surprises, and nada yada yada. Stop by one of over 6,000 Metro stores nationwide. When you get a new car or a new home, your first reaction might be to say things like, oh yeah, or I can't believe it, or booyah. But what you really want to say is the one thing that can get you the help you need. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm is there with the coverage you need for your car, your home, and even boats, motorcycles, RVs, and other things that matter to you. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is there to help you choose the coverage you need. With so many coverage options, it feels good knowing you can find what fits for you. And when you need ways to get help, State Farm gives you options there too, in person or on the phone with your local agent, or on statefarm.com, where their award-winning app State Farm lets you do things your way. So when you need help protecting the things that matter most, remember to say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And my style with Steve was that if I didn't agree with him, first of all, I knew, I was self-aware enough to know that I absolutely could not think as fast as he could.
Right. I mean,
he's really smart.
You're not going to debate him. You're not going to jump in. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are people who actually can push back with him and argue with him successfully. So there's something that's not known about Steve, but he actually values people that push back on him. But I can't think that fast. So instead, he'd shoot down what I say, and then I would say, well, let me get back to that. And I'd wait a week. So I'd think about my next sentence.
Right, for a week.
For a week. And then I would give it to him and he'd shoot it down. Let me get back to you. So this might go on for weeks. In a couple of cases, it went on for months. And there'd be one of three outcomes. I'd say each one was about equally likely. One of them was we reach a point when I would say, oh, I see what you're saying. You're right. And that ends it. About a third of the time, he would say, okay, got it. You're right. End of discussion. Just like, you just bought what I said, and that was it. I didn't explain it very well the first time.
Sure.
And one of the reasons I would do this is I never confuse the personal power that somebody might have or their position with what was right. So it didn't matter if somebody was a better debater or could think faster than I could, or they were in a senior position. I didn't mean they were right. So it just meant that I couldn't argue at the same rate. So I just didn't give up as long as I knew that I was right. And if I wasn't right, then I would change. So the other third of the time is we didn't reach a conclusion. So in that third, I just did what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And Steve was okay with it because we had discussed it. And that's how it worked.
Oh, interesting.
For all those years.
How many years did you work with him?
He acquired us at that time. We were then a public company. So we were a public company until we were acquired by Disney. And then at Disney, the terms of it was that we had the equivalent of a board of directors. We're just now a group within Disney. And I had a dual report to Bob Iger and to the head of the studio.
Wow.
But we had this steering committee. And so the steering committee was John, Steve, and me. And then Bob Iger, the chairman of the studio, and the CFO of the company.
Wow.
So like every month to begin with, and it slowly
sure
got me there. But now this group would come in, and they were like our board of directors. So that continued up until the end of his life.
How many years total, kind of in that range, is that? When you first...
Well, from 86, and I forget what year he died.
Wow, then 10 or 11, I think, or...
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, okay, so 30-something years.
Yeah.
Roughly. Yeah, it's amazing. What were the three biggest lessons you learned from observing Steve Jobs, from communicating with him, and from the way he left the world?
Well, in the case of... Like, what are the lessons? One of them, which he understood intuitively, which was that when you're wrong, you change. Now, I mean, there's different ways of phrasing it. It's like that there's no upside in being wrong. And some people think they need to win the argument. And Steve actually understood that was never the point. It was, you want to get to the truth quickly. But he also understood that at an intuitive level, that because of the power of his personality, it actually could distort the process. And that was part of his learning as he went through this, was the recognizing, what was him recognizing that his abilities, his like superpowers, could actually get in the way of him finding out things. So I'll give a couple examples. One of them, which would surprise people, was that we had a board of directors, because in 1995, at the end, we went public. And this is like a big public offering. We were the second largest IPO of 1995, only after Netscape.
And when did Toy Story come out?
In 95.
95.
So we went public 1 week afterwards.
Wow.
So when we were doing the road trip, and part of the road trip
showing the movie
was, well, actually it wasn't showing the movie. it was telling people that we had a new technology that was going to change filmmaking. So now it's a complete confidence that this film is going to be a big success.
Wow.
But he could say to them, nobody else can do this. There isn't anything like it. It's going to change the industry. And we've got the people that changed the technology, and they're doing the content. So that's what this company is. But we're not going to go public until after the movie comes out, because we think that we should show you how big this is.
Wow.
Before we go public.
Smart.
So that was what we did for the few months leading up to going public.
You were telling a story about the story.
Yes.
Wow.
And that we were going to prove it.
And you guys did.
And we did.
You proved it big.
So
what was that first week like? Toy Story launches, box office, and then you go public the next week later. What was that week like?
It was surreal.
What were the numbers of the box office and then going public?
Interestingly enough, what I remember at the time, because our whole group at the time would go to our computer graphics conference, which is SIGGRAPH. And for the most part, it's showing the newest technology. And we believe firmly, because we made short films, and they were actually Academy Award winning short films, and they're quite impactful, but they're short. And people would always pay attention on the outside to the technology. So when the film came out, the biggest question that we had, and everybody was looking for it, and all of the technology people were looking for it, was what are the reviewers going to pay attention to? And what we found was that almost every review, there was at most one or two sentences about the new technology, and the rest of the review was about the movie.
Wow.
And that, for all of us, was like, that's the win. It wasn't about the technology.
It was about being a great movie.
Yes. And if we had done that, and we got people to buy into this world and watch it and feel it, then that was the win. And everybody understood it at every level in the company.
Wow.
And so that's what I remember, was reading those things to find out whether or not we had really accomplished what we wanted to do.
It's incredible. I mean, what I'm curious about is how were you able to tap into the human mind and create emotional connections with audiences through these animations? How was this studied and executed for the last 30 years at such a high level? And how did you do that for that first movie?
Well, I will say that for the first movie, it's one of those things where there is some luck in that group that first came in. We had always, in the history of both at New York Tech and then at Lucasfilm and then at Pixar, was to say we really want to hire the very best. And so I would say, well, we want to hire people who are smarter than I am. And I know other people say that, but because like what does that even mean? But it means that you don't want to be threatened by the people that you hire, and they just have to have these extraordinary skills. And so when we were building out our technical group, I mean, they were just really good. I mean, they had passed me in terms of their understanding of the technology. And John understood that too. So when he did his first hires, the first person he hired was Andrew Stanton, and then the second was Pete Docter, and then Joe Ranft came in, and then we brought in really to be an editor, except he turns out to have been this is like one of the best storytellers ever, is Lee Unkrich. So this is this amazing group of people that came together. And now part of it was we really had established a culture where that this was the right thing to do, is you aren't bringing in, you weren't even thinking about them as, who's going to be second to me? It's like, who's really good? And it turns out that Andrew had this extraordinarily structural sense. So we didn't know that when we hired.
Right.
It's just like it emerged because of the challenge. And Pete Docter had this incredible emotional core.
Wow.
And still does. I mean, so he went on to do Up, Inside Out. It's like getting the emotion right. It's like who he is. And Lee has this actually phenomenal filmmaking sense of, okay, we're doing this, but you really have to get all these pieces right. And then the person that was Sharon Callahan initially, who was thinking about the lighting, and people aren't often aware of this, but the lighting is really important for conveying the emotions. And then the artist that we had, Ralph Eggleston, had a color palette for the movie, because it turns out the basic color changed throughout the movie, and it's this subtle thing that's affecting your perceptions.
Wow.
So, like, this is this amazing group of people. And the interesting thing about it was that none of these people had ever made a feature film before in their life.
Oh, my goodness.
So we hadn't used computer graphics, but they also hadn't done a 2D film. They hadn't done any film. So
it's unbelievable.
Everybody is a beginner. They all had to figure it out.
And you're leading them.
Yeah.
How do you know? I mean, yeah, the emotional, the emotions you're able to pull out of people, you know, in these films through, you're a technology guy, but through the tech, through the art, through the color, through the lighting, through the sound design and the music, through the tonality of the voice actors, and bringing it all together to create a cohesive emotional story is unbelievable how you guys did this. And well, how you continue to do it, but how did you know how to put it all together?
Well, I mean, the way I thought at the time is how do you have a group that works together? Because I'm not a filmmaker. And over time we developed a way of helping people, which ended up being called the Brain Trust. But my view was, when I went to these meetings, was how do we make sure this group works together? Like, what are the things that make it work together? What takes them off the rails? So it was to work out some principles for that. And it's fun to give notes to movie, but the truth was, there's only one movie in all those movies that I gave a note that I felt so strongly about that I had to push really hard to get it in there.
What was that?
It was in Monsters Incorporated.
What was the note?
Well, the note was, at one point near the end, the monster, Sully, has to scare this dummy, which is being videoed. It's like a training video. And you may recall that when he does this, he then looks up and he sees that the girl's right there, and he scares the bejesus out of this little girl, the one he loves. And he didn't mean to do it. But the original thing, what she saw was that she saw him on the monitor. So I looked at this and I said, you can't do this, because anybody that has a child remembers there are times when they may have done something that where their child was in danger, either because of themselves or it happened to them. And when that happens, it sears into your soul and you never forget it for as long as you live.
Wow.
And that for Sully, he needs to see that he was the cause of the thing that scared her, that it was not good enough to have her see it by the monitor. So, and so there's some pushback on it. And you know, I talked with Andrew, and so Andrew said, no, this is actually critical to the film. And so, and I just felt, so, oh, good. But that's it.
Right.
And so I can look at it, well, I did one at least.
One note in 30 movies, yeah.
But that wasn't my job.
Yeah. I mean,
they're the filmmakers. It wasn't my job. It was to say, okay, is this group working well together? Why isn't derailing? When does it go well? When doesn't it go well? And so that was the whole time. And then when Jim Morris came in, initially over, he came in as producer, and then he was our head of production, and then he was our general manager, and then he became the president. It was like, we're both like, you know, we're in there just looking at the process and what works, what doesn't work.
Right.
And you're just evolving it.
Right.
So for time.
I mean, you got pretty animated during this retelling a story with Monsters, Inc. What movie left you with the deepest amount of emotion when you watched it after it came out or in the process of making it? What was the movie that captivated you the most? I'm sure that's hard to say which one you liked the most, but was there a moment in a movie that really touched you in a way based on your own life experience, different than the other emotional moments in movies?
Well, it was, it's a little hard to say because any emotion in a movie connects to watching the people go through this. So I can't even watch a movie in the same way that others do because I'm actually seeing what took place.
The creators, the producers, everything leading
up to
the movie, yeah.
I mean, they're just, you know, these films all at the beginning have problems. It's just one thing after another. And we go through multiple steps and with different ways of trying to fix the problems. And in fact, it was one of the things I wanted to like clarify with the expanded edition of the book was that, I talked a fair amount about, failure and how it's part of the process. But I realized that it doesn't actually capture what takes place because we all know that we learn from failures. In fact, failure is kind of popular to talk about nowadays about a way of learning. The reality is that we have two meanings to failure which are deeply built into us. So there's one meaning, which is that we know that we've had failures and we learn from them and it's part of the process of learning. The other meaning is the one that we got in school, and that is if you fail a class, it's because you screwed up, you didn't work hard enough, or you're dumb, right? None of those are good meanings.
Right.
All right, now you go out into business, bridges fail, relationships fail, companies fail, and in politics and business, failures are used as bludgeons with which to beat opponents. There is real and palpable fear behind failure. All right, so if we talk about failure, then it is almost possible for most people to emotionally disconnect those two concepts. And so I realized that that's what I observe, that at Pixar, well, we also say that failure is part of the process. It does happen.
Yes.
We don't actually use the terminology very much. Now, there are times when you have something which actually does fail, so we don't avoid it. You have to, like, if something really fails, you say it. But the terminology of making a film is, since we know they all have problems, is we're trying to solve the problem. That solution didn't work. Let's try this. So the iterative process is we're trying it. Let's try this. And as long as the team is working well together, even if they haven't solved the problem, if they're working well together, we say, okay, keep going. It's a tough problem. And they know that. They know we have their back. The only real clue we have that we have to do a major change is if the crew begins to lose the confidence that a leader can actually get them there. They may like the leader. And this is not, I don't like them. It's more like, I just don't have the confidence we're going to get there. And those things start to build, so we are aware of some of them because people will come and talk about some of the problems they've got. So you then start off, how do we help the person? How do we supplement them? Could we add somebody to the team? Do we remove somebody? What are the things we can do behind the scene to help them? And if we get to the point where we can't do it, then we'll do a bigger change. And we essentially have failed. And it's tough because we picked the person to be the failure because we believe they can do it because they're very good. So for them, it's actually a very difficult process to go through.
When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. Like when you're trying to buy tickets for the best seat at your favorite team's big game, or when you're hiring for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. With ZipRecruiter, you can find qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I believe finding the right team member is one of the most important steps in setting up my company for success. We like to ensure our new hires will be a good fit before they're even on the team. So I am grateful that I have ZipRecruiter's help when we want to grow the team fast. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I've learned the hard way that constantly holding on to your emotions and repeatedly choosing to not talk about your feelings will only make you feel worse and worse. And up until about 10 or 11 years ago, I was afraid to talk about my trauma that I experienced. And I know we all carry around different stressors, big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. But therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to fit your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Lewis today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/LEWIS.
And we've only had a couple of the directors who could survive this and stay with the company. And they're very valuable. And those who have stayed were actually incredible contributors, but it's emotionally hard for them to go through.
Right.
But one of those was with Ratatouille.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who designed it conceived of the idea of a lovely man. He's really very good. In fact, the look of the film that you see came from this guy.
Wow.
But the film was stuck, and they couldn't get out of it. And so at that point, due to other reasons that were on, was, Brad Bird had finished Mission, Miss Impossible. He did that later.
Sure.
He had actually finished The Incredibles.
Uh-huh.
So we asked him to take it on.
Interesting.
And
now, when the movie is stuck, do you mean it's stuck in the beginning stages, or it's in post-production, or it's like the story needs to adjust?
The story is
stuck. So the story's not complete yet.
That's right.
So you've got the story, but you're like, well, we need changes here, or it's not really fully emotionally connecting, or the journey doesn't work. Is that what you mean?
Yes. But in the meantime, we're building the models. We call the assets.
You're building the characters,
the characters,
the backgrounds, the animation. You're building it without the story complete.
That's right.
Wow.
So, and there are pieces of it that we think are working, so we'll start to make them. Because you can't make the whole thing at the end, so you need to start to make it.
You make like one scene. You're like,
yeah.
We like this part, we think this will work.
We think it's going to, you're right. Maybe it's going to work. We might be wrong, so sometimes you may throw that away.
Really?
That's expensive.
So it's kind of like shooting a scene that you don't use. But you've got 1,000 people animating something and working on...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's to try things, you figure them out.
Sure.
Because what is the lighting? What's the character going to look like? How is this going to work? So they're doing all this work, but you can't get too far ahead of yourself.
Get on the story complete.
Yeah, so it's a tricky balance, but it's always a tricky balance.
Yeah.
You know, life is a tricky balance. So in this case, the characters look beautiful. It's everything's gorgeous about it. It's not working. And there are a few things that are just fundamentally wrong. One of them was that originally that chef, the chef Gusteau, was alive throughout the whole movie. Okay? And he kind of sold his soul. He was actually a highly rated chef, but he was making money because of advertising and using his name to sell products. Mm-hmm. And
he was consulting on the movie, is that right? Or the chef that was consulting?
No, the chef in the movie.
Gotcha.
The chef in the was the fat guy. He was alive.
Gotcha. Because there was a consultant, I think I saw a photo over here of like a consultant showing you how to make.
That's the research we do.
Gotcha.
Like we're trying to learn what takes place.
Sure, but the chef it's based on, he's alive.
No. We made up a chef.
Got it.
Gusteau.
Yes.
And he's this fat guy, and he's kind of lost his way. And then there's this rat that wants to cook who just happens to end up being in his kitchen.
Yes.
And because of the passion of the rat, then it actually causes the chef to realize he went down the wrong path. So now you've got this problem throughout a lot of the movie is this movie about the rat who wants to cook with that passion? Or is it a redemption story for the chef who has lost his way?
Mm.
And then the other problem that they were wrestling with was that the rat has a family. The rat doesn't talk to humans. So he's going through, he's meeting people and learning things in the restaurant, but because he can't talk, you don't know what he's thinking. And then he goes back to his family and he explains what he just went through. But you just saw this. When you're watching a movie, you just saw this. So now it brings the movie to a dead halt because he's explaining to them the things that you just saw. That's not good for filmmaking.
Mm.
So Brad Bird enters the picture. Brad looks at it, and the first thing he does after working with a good friend of his who is a good screenwriter, they kill the chef.
Mm-hmm.
So the chef died for some reason, but he's still on these TV programs because he'd been teaching on whatever the channel was, and the rat's inspired by him. But because the chef is dead and Remy knows the chef is dead, then the chef is now a figment of his imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So what this means is that this figment of his imagination can sort of pop up and he's interacting with what he thinks the chef
would
is.
Teach him or tell him, yes.
So it takes care of two huge problems. One of them is we now know who the movie's about. It's about the rat that wants to cook. So problem number one is solved. And the second one was, because he cannot talk to the figment of his imagination, and it doesn't feel unnatural because it's not like he's talking to a ghost. He's actually, you know that he's talking to himself, or if it sounds clear. So that means that he doesn't need to go back and explain anything to his family, so you know what he's thinking at the time. So now the pacing starts to work. Now that's the brilliance of Brad Bird, is to come in and say, oh, here's what we're going to do for good storytelling at every step of the way. And so now this film, which had these interesting elements about it, turns into something which is brilliant. And then Brad has his own take about art and what it means to critique art and its impact of it. And he puts this in the movie. Because you're watching this movie thinking, well, like, where's it going? Because a rat can never really run a restaurant in Paris. Like, is it going to happen? So that's what makes it hard. So he takes this hard concept and he turns it into this thing at the end, which is profound.
Mm.
And then when the audience sees it, it's like, oh, I didn't see this coming. And this is beautiful. And so what I remember about the movies is actually going into the audiences, because I remember we had the big opening in Paris.
Wow, it's cool.
And I would get to that moment, and what I would do is I would turn around and look at the audience. And that was the rewarding part.
As they're watching the final scenes or the whole movie?
No, it's that final scene.
Yeah.
Where I'd look at them, and they were going like this. Because they didn't see it coming.
That's incredible.
And it was. That's what it was. It was incredible. And then, like, because so that's rewarding when something like that happened. And
was there ever a time you cried in your own watching your own premiere?
Oh, I did for
because of
Toy
the movie.
Story 3.
Really?
For Toy Story 3, and I did for Coco.
Oh my gosh, that's my favorite movie. Coco's I've got a Mexican girlfriend, and so her whole family is from Mexico, and you know, just whenever they come over to our house, it feels like I'm in Coco. In America. And whenever I go to Mexico, it feels like I'm in Coco. So for me, that's one of my favorite movies of all movies. It's incredible.
Well, that was, you know, it was Lee Unkrich. It actually created a problem because it was so good that afterwards, Lee says, where do I go from here?
It was unbelievable.
But
you cried in Coco.
And incidentally, he directed both of those films.
Wow. You cried in Coco.
Oh, yeah.
What part made you?
Well, it was... the thing about any good movie of this sort or the kind of movies that we try to tell is that you are trying to connect to our own personal emotions, but you're also trying to bring in something new and original. Because to be honest, there's unfortunately sort of this bias against the Mexican culture, because what do people hear about on the news in terms of immigration or various things at the border? But they don't represent Mexico, and they don't represent what takes place like in southern Mexico with, you know, the Day of the Dead. I mean, if you say the Day of the Dead in America, it's like, oh, it's kind of odd, you know, the Day of the Dead. But it means something entirely different there. It's like the respect for the people that came before us. That's what it's about. So, and you actually get that in the movie. So they went down into the villages in southern Mexico, and they spent a lot of time getting to know the people, talking with them. We had a group in California. They were like Mexican advisors because we wanted to get it right. And essentially, you've got these people from North America going down into Mexico. I mean, they're in North America too. So you got people, from America going down. Well, how are they going to tell that story? So they work really hard to try to capture that. The same was true with like Moana. It's like
another great
in,
movie, incredible.
And you actually try to get something from the culture because you don't want to work off the biases.
Right.
You don't want to work off of what other people are thinking. And the same was true with Ratatouille. It's like, you know, we all know cooking in the home. We watched our parents cook or we cook. We watched the cooking channel. You can see the chefs in the kitchen. But what is it like to actually be in a highly rated, fancy restaurant in any place? What's the culture like? We don't know that. So for Ratatouille, they went into those restaurants and got to know them. And they also were given some work. Like at the French Laundry, they actually spent time in the kitchen and they were given jobs to do.
Wow.
And so they were capturing that. Now, what's interesting about it is even though we know a lot about cooking, we don't know whether or not what they're saying in the kitchen, the way they're acting, is true. Right? We just don't know. But they sense that it is. If you've actually done your research and you put that in the film, then there's something that is conveying to people because you took the time to find out something new and original. So in the case of Coco, it was to go down and find out how do they feel about it? What are they doing? What are they thinking? And I remember this is when the movie came out, because we went down to the premiere, and one of the things I appreciate is that when Americans make movies about Mexico, they don't know the difference between the Mexican broad-brimmed hat and the Spanish one. So they like to interchange them. But in Mexico, they know. So they went down there, and they wanted to get those details right. And most of the audiences, they wouldn't know. But they felt like they needed to have the people who would know that it was right.
Sure. What was the part of the movie that emotionally captivated you the most in Coco?
Well, it was, I mean, because the intent was, it actually is the respect for these people that came before. It's like, because it was real. You know, he'd learned something, he figured out something about the people that came before him. He also felt like he was able to fix some things that were wrong. But it was also emotional for me for a couple other reasons too. One is in the storytelling was that initially Lee was going to make this as Pixar's first musical, because Pixar really doesn't have musicals in their DNA. Disney does, and Pixar doesn't. And one of the things I want to make sure is that we didn't try to make one studio like the other. We also weren't trying to say you have to be different. So they had to evolve in their own one, in their own way. So if one wants to make a musical, then they can. And at Pixar, if they want to make a musical, they can. And so Lou was going to be the first person to do that. So we got these brilliant two people who also had done something down at Disney. So, I mean, they were, you know, good and close, and we worked with them before. And so they wrote the first song for his movie, which is called Remember Me.
Incredible.
And so, but as a filmmaker, he said, okay, that's thematic for the movie. So now he builds a story using this song throughout it. All right, so it's now a key element of where did it come from? Why was it written? And the notion was that, you know, if his great-grandma dies, that she's the last person who will know where the song came from. And she's got...
Oh, my God. She remembers it.
Yeah. And she's got Alzheimer. it's so emotional, actually.
I know.
But by playing it, and she remembers, it actually gives him life. So, wow. Is seeing that and conveying that.
That's beautiful.
Makes it powerful.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing about the story, which is a separate thing, was like, how did it get started? So one of the things we figured out, this is very early on in Pixar, when we started our second movie, well, the second was Bugs Life, but the third one was going to be a sequel. No sequel had ever been successful, right? An animated sequel had ever been successful. So the thought was originally by Disney was that this is going to be a direct video. So we start to make it, but right away it's clear that the people working on it at Pixar are very upset, because to work on a sequel at a studio where we want to have the highest standard of quality means that we're working on something where the expectations is much lower. We don't want to do something where there are low expectations. We want it to be, you know, at a high level. So Disney agreed to that. So we then started to make this film, and we frankly had several problems with it, because we were building on some assumptions that we got from the first film. Because the first film had been built knowing nothing, but we drew some conclusions from it, and some of the conclusions we drew from it were not correct. So we started the sequel based on those assumptions, only to find that we were wrong. And we just uncovered a bunch of things to question or challenge our original ideas. So, and in the process of doing that, we had to restart the movie really late in the game and remake it. It was like a brutal, brutal effort to remake this movie. We had to make it 8 months, starting from scratch almost. Wow. Oh, yeah, it was a nightmare. We had like a third of our people injured with RSI.
And, oh, man.
But one of the things that came out of that was the realization that the way we were starting films is we were trying to do what other studios do, which was to have a development department looking for good scripts. And so our thought was, why are we trying to copy the model of other studios? First of all, the success rate of films of the studios isn't very high.
Low, yeah.
So we said, let's do it a different way. So what we did was we're going to pick somebody who we think can direct a feature film. Then we're going to say to them, pick three ideas to develop. So now, the reason we say three is instead of saying, pick an idea that you want to make into a film. Well, what happens to all of us when you do something tough or in school or something like that? You start to bang your head against, well, you get stuck. So the reason we said three was why is that if you get stuck, you can switch to a different idea.
Right.
So they have an artist, and at some point they may have a writer come in and work with them. So it's like a really small team spending a year, and there's some help of the development department. We still have the development department, but they were no longer looking for scripts to turn into movies. Their job was to help support this small group. So they read scripts, but all they were looking for was good writers who can join the team, but we never made anybody else's script. We always
started from scratch. Wow.
So they would then spend that year going back and forth between their three ideas. And at the end of the year, they would come in, you know, the two or three people who were now the leaders over this, and they would pitch it to the creative leadership of the company, say some of the other directors. So there may be like 10, 12 people in the room.
The three ideas.
And the way this works is there's a story room, which holds, there's a table in the middle, and so essentially you can hold like 12 people in the room. And there are two long walls, and there's storyboards along the wall, and they would cover them up. So they'd put the material, the conceptual ideas for the film on the wall, and they'd take like 20, 25 minutes, present the idea, there'd be a brief discussion on it. And then we go through the three films. Now the process started, and they all did this, even though they've been on the other side, like they've been on the creative leadership side, and then there'd be time when they'd pitch their ideas. And they'd all start saying the same thing. They would say, "I love all three ideas equally."
Right.
It doesn't matter to me which one you pick. Now, it's not true. They do like one better. And the debate when they leave the room is not which is the best idea to make in the film. It is which one do they really want to make? And I think we've always called it right, because when we'd come back and they'd go, "Yes, I was hoping you'd pick that one."
Sure, sure.
But in the case of Coco, Pete came in and he pitched an idea which is related to an idea that he pitched before he did Toy Story 3. And then when we had the ability to make Toy Story 3, he was asked to direct it, and so he switched over along with the writer he worked with, Michael Arndt, brilliant writer. And they developed a good relationship. So basically Lee was pitching that idea they originally had. Then he pitched his second idea, which was to be a full-on musical. The interesting concept, challenging concept. And then the two walls were up, so then we go into the other room. So he opened the door, and when we opened the door, the table, the ceiling, both walls, and the end wall are filled with Mexican artwork.
Really?
So there isn't a single word that's said, and everybody knows which movie we're making.
Yeah, there's a poster bozo of the first two, but this one is a whole experience.
That's right.
You walked into Coco World.
That's right. You walk into Coco World.
Wow.
Now, the interesting part, which this is the way it works, is the final movie actually was very little like that first thing.
Mm.
It didn't matter.
Right.
Because you start off with the concept. You're going to learn something. The whole idea of all these trips to Mexico was to learn something, because everything else is sort of based on, you know, kind of things you knew.
Right.
Because you're interested in stereotypes and so forth. So you expect it to change pretty dramatically in the process of doing it.
So when he pitched Coco, and you guys went back and decided, like, okay, this is the movie we're choosing of these three, was there a debate, or was everyone just like, oh, we know he's the most passionate about this idea. Let's let him run with the thing he's most passionate about.
I think in that case, there probably wasn't any debate.
Mm.
I would say with others, there is some question about, okay, which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably more than normal. Like, there'd be a little debate about it.
Right.
And also, not everybody goes through the process. Like, if Andrew Stanton says he wants to make something, it's like, okay, Andrew, you can make whatever you want.
I hope today's episode inspired you on your journey towards greatness. Make sure to check out the show notes in the description for a rundown of today's show with all the important links. And if you want weekly exclusive bonus episodes with me, as well as ad-free listening experience, make sure to subscribe to our Greatness Plus channel on Apple Podcast. If you enjoyed this, please share it with a friend over on social media, or text a friend. Leave us a review over on Apple Podcast, and let me know what you learned over on our social media channels at Lewis House. I really love hearing the feedback from you, and it helps us continue to make the show better. And if you want more inspiration from our world-class guests and content to learn how to improve the quality of your life, then make sure to sign up for the Greatness Newsletter and get it delivered right to your inbox over at greatness.com/newsletter. And if no one has told you today, I want to remind you that you are loved, you are worthy, and you matter. And now it's time to go out there and do something great.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.